The Government Gurus is a podcast developed by AP Government teachers designed to cover the new AP curriculum. The mission of the Gurus is to help teachers engage students through a thoughtful conversation on the material and to provide teachers with strategies to produce the best classroom experience for their students. So please join us on this exciting journey as we explore our constitution, its principles, and discuss the complex issues facing our society today.
Andrew, I want to welcome you back to the podcast. I know we had spoken, I think, earlier on political ideology, and I had emailed you on Facebook this week because I was looking for activities to do on civil liberties, and I came across in the share drive an assignment that you had given your students, and it was dealing with the monsters are due on Maple Street, and I wanted you to discuss what this was about, and it's a good lesson for teachers to do. I did it this week, and part of this podcast was not only the information, but giving teachers ideas on things they could work on in the classroom. So welcome back, and I'm glad you're here.
Okay, thank you very much for having me back. It is good to be back. This assignment on the monsters are doing Maple Street, the idea behind it was years ago, I had found it difficult getting students to understand the concept of due process of law. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to kind of go for it. And I typed up a sheet of paper that had different excerpts from the Magna Carta, the U.S. Constitution, and then a couple of excerpts from Supreme Court opinions on what due process is. Because when you look at it, and even when Supreme Court justices are discussing it, it can feel kind of fuzzy. And so I picked the Twilight Zone episode, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. And lest anyone think that I'm just sacrificing some time in class for entertainment purposes, a lot of the old Twilight Zone episodes, the original Twilight Zone episodes, were nice little morality plays. And there were a lot of them that dealt with fundamental issues, some of them of a philosophical nature, but some of them of a political or judicial nature of justice. So with Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, we had talked about due process of law, and I had given them those excerpts. And then I wanted them to watch the episode and then react to it. There's a short essay assignment, informal essay assignment that went with it, in which I asked the students to watch the episode and then think about what our deepest notions are of what is fair and right and just. And that's actually a quote from Justice Frankfurter in a 1950 Supreme Court case in which he says due process is that which comports with our deepest notions of what is fair and right and just. And basically ask them, is that what's going on in this episode? How do we know what justice is? How do we know what fairness is? How do we set those rules? And I wanted them to be thinking in bigger picture terms as we watched and had them write and reflect on it.
It's shown, I think, 1960. You commented fair, right, and just, and I asked my students, well, first off, what is due process? And the short version I tell them is that it's basically all your legal rights. But from there, you know, what is the baseline that the government provides us? And I talked to them after the short film, which is about 25 minutes. And it's like, well, what is fair? What is right? And what is just? And I started asking the students, well, what do you think? We all have definitions of what we think is fair, what we think is right, and what we think is just. The Monsters on Maple or Joe on Maple Street, I think, really does an excellent job. It's, you know, set in the suburbs. It's nice, clean, cookie cutter, what everything's supposed to be in normal, but it's got a very powerful message, not only with due process, but it really, I think the notion behind it is you're beginning the civil rights movement, and some people are accused of behaving differently or being different against societal norms. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you were a lawyer before, right?
Not exactly. I was a teacher first, and then there was a period of time that I had moved to Houston and went to the University of Houston Law Center at night while I was still in education during the day. That's how I got my law degree and became a lawyer, but I stayed in education.
I thought I had read that. So from your expertise, what is due process then? What would the go-to answer be?
Well, first, let me say it's kind of hard to have a go-to answer, but the first thing that we have to do is distinguish between two kinds of due process. The first is procedural due process, and the next is substantive due process. I will say that when you look at Supreme Court opinions on matters of due process of law, just about all of the justices would agree that due process of law absolutely definitely includes procedural due process, but not all of them agree on the idea of substantive due process. So procedural due process is basically the process of your procedural rights if you are accused or come under suspicion, charged, your rights at trial, even if you're convicted, what rights you have to protect you against cruel and unusual punishment, that all of these things can be considered as being encompassed by due process of law. In fact, you could probably argue that for about half of the Bill of Rights, when Madison was drafting it, all he really needed to put was guaranteed due process of law, and that probably would have covered everything, but they did want to spell certain things out specifically. Almost everything that they spelled out in the Bill of Rights that is encompassed by due process represented somehow the British violated in the colonies or historically violated certain rights of the accused, even though Britain was supposed to have due process of law.
For example, like the Fourth Amendment tackles the writs of assistance, which were blanket search warrants by the British officers.
Right.
In colonial times. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. And the idea of British officials accused being tried, or British soldiers being accused of crimes being tried back in Britain rather than being tried where the crime occurred.
It was committed. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
I should also say that there are rights that are part of procedural due process that are not specifically mentioned in the Constitution. You will hear people say, oh, this is a constitutional right. Well, it is in the sense that it's part of due process of law. But for example, the idea that if you're accused of a crime, you must be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And in every state and at the federal level, except for Louisiana, the verdict of guilty must be unanimous. And I honestly thought it was like in all 50 states. I mean, who doesn't do that? Well, apparently Louisiana didn't. And so that was up for changing that. And so you do have those that are included with procedural due process. Now, substantive due process takes it a step further. Because what the due process clause in the Fifth Amendment, and it's nearly identical in its verbiage in the 14th Amendment, says, nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And there is an argument that has been made that that was never intended to be limited to just procedural due process, that it is kind of invoking a higher law, natural law, really the common law in Britain, the unwritten law, the sense of what is right and what is wrong. And this is why you get, for instance, Justice Frankfurter, when he's defining it, saying, let me find the quote here, saying, due process of law is a system of rights based on moral principles so deeply embedded in the traditions and feelings of our people as to be deemed fundamental to a civilized society as conceived by our whole history. Due process is that which comports with the deepest notions of what is fair and right and just. So the idea of substantive due process would take that further and offer further protections of people's rights, even rights that are not necessarily specifically listed, against other kinds of government action, not just the process of going through a trial.
In relation with the Ninth, with the powers not, or the rights not listed, doesn't mean they don't exist. Is this, the notion of implied and powers and rights is littered throughout the Constitution. So is this what Frankfurter is really saying? Is that, I'm looking at the term and the definition, and it allows the courts to protect these certain fundamental rights from government interference, even if procedural protections are present. So yeah, like you said, it's like an added barrier to go beyond what the Constitution says, even if it, they've missed something.
The reason why the Ninth Amendment exists, Madison said that one of the objections to even having a Bill of Rights that he thought made a good argument was actually what Hamilton wrote in Federalist 84, in which Hamilton argues against having a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, although Madison, in the passage that I read, didn't mention Hamilton by name. And at that point, I'm not surprised. But no, Hamilton makes the argument that why list rights that are protected when the government has no power to violate these rights? He says that the fact that you're listing off these rights would offer a colorable pretext. I remember that phrase, a colorable pretext for people to claim that there were more powers that were granted. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, like, why, for instance, say that freedom of the press shall not be violated when there exists no power to do that? And so somebody might be disposed to try to argue, well, there must be something, some power there if we need to protect against it. And so because of that argument, Madison basically wrote the Ninth Amendment, which says the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, there are law professors out there and even judges for whom the Ninth Amendment is just kind of a quaint expression of, oh yeah, we have these other rights. But how the Supreme Court would go about recognizing rights that we know we have yet are not listed is more problematic. There have been certain court opinions where the Ninth Amendment has figured in to some of the justices' reasoning, like in Griswold versus Connecticut. But there's never been a case that would be decided solely on the Ninth Amendment itself.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this like examples of these fundamental rights where they've expanded and where the court could protect the idea of interstate travel. You mentioned privacy, the right of marriage, the right of self-defense, and the right to parent one's children. And when these rights are denied to a group, then these issues fall under the substantive due process. And so we look at like Obergefell versus Hodges, or, you know, there's a right granted to a group to marry and another that's not. But this, I think, is a perfect example that you have the procedural due process. But what about the rights that aren't listed? What kind of protections do they get under the Constitution? And you know, it's right there with substantive due process and equal protection under the law.
And one of the things that the court will do in some cases, in cases that we could call civil rights cases, if we're talking about the right to marry, who you get to marry, like Loving versus Virginia, or, you know, the Obergefell case and rights related to that, that you could theoretically make an argument that those are protected by due process of law. And sometimes that's what the court uses. But other times it kind of just goes over to the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment, especially if we're talking about a state law. And they'll rely on the Equal Protection Clause as being a more solid foundation for knocking down a state law that discriminates against a certain group. But there have been cases in the mid-20th century where there was kind of a, do they rely on the Due Process Clause? Do they rely on the Equal Protection Clause? There are some justices that have never been entirely comfortable with the idea of substantive due process, and some of them just reject it outright.
Yeah, I'm looking at, you know, you do right to marry and the criticisms, and I think the last one, looking at like Cruzan versus Missouri, and due process is not violated, the state applies, and like with evidence. But there's some cases where, yeah, the judges are locally with, you know, Justice Kennedy questioning some of the substantive due process. But yeah, equal protection, because it's, I think, more solidly because it is written in the Constitution. It's written in the 14th Amendment. And it's very difficult to argue with something that is actually written in the Constitution versus this idea. It expands these fundamental rights. It's interesting because privacy is not written in the Constitution and people have a reasonable understanding of privacy, but then again, it can be controversial about what is considered private.
The cases regarding privacy, that's where you have Justice Douglas and the theory of, if we're going to recognize rights that are not specifically listed, they must come under the penumbra of other rights. And, you know, even that didn't entirely sit well with other justices either. So
was it emanations like something, right? This penumbra, these zones of privacy and these zones of rights have to come from somewhere. And for privacy, it comes under this idea of, you know, what, the first, second, third, Fourth and Ninth Amendment, they said, well, there's obviously an idea of privacy here. And then that's where that zone is created. We actually just went over that in class. So that's the beginning of the due process, the procedural versus substantive. You know, earlier we talked about, and I tell my kids that really you see these due process, all your legal rights starting with really that Fourth Amendment and going to the Eighth Amendment. And, you know, I always tell my students that the Bill of Rights, I said, you got five total amendments dealing with protections of in case there's criminal activity or accused of a crime. I mean, that was very, I mean, think about how powerful that is. Yes. Against government action. They were very concerned about, yes. And it looked because of their experiences in colonial America.
No, absolutely. But not only that, but what they knew from British legal and constitutional history. Think of the Court of Star Chamber, whose yeah. proceedings were secret. Or in the Magna Carta, I can't remember which article in the Magna Carta, but basically it affirmed, let's see if I have it here, it affirmed a right to a trial by jury. Now, trial by jury had existed prior to the Magna Carta. Common law in England had been developing for a while before that, but it affirmed that you can't just hold somebody without a jury trial. And in, I think, the Petition of Right yep. in 1628, where Parliament made Charles sign it, one of the things that Charles, like some previous English kings had done, is somebody would speak out against him, well, go directly to jail. And we'll get to you when we get to you. And there was no trial. And so finally, Parliament passes the Habeas Corpus Act in 1679 that says that you can't hold mm-hmm. someone indefinitely. And that's also something that comes under this idea of due process. But it's something, you know, there was plenty of instances in British history that the men that wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and who voted on the Bill of Rights, they were very mindful, not just of their experience as colonies, but also some of the stuff that had happened within the last few hundred years.
Yeah, I found the clause. It's clause 39. And yeah, and it took them, you know, the Petition of Right, English Bill of Rights, and it continued to identify these core rights, the rights of Englishmen, that the colonists eventually, you know, they said, hey, we're Englishmen, we get these rights. And the Crown's like, not so fast. It's just interesting that it was able to solidify within the new Constitution. And it was, you know, for the most part, the United States has worked on it, that we're trying to follow the letter of the law. Back to the TV show, I guess the show or the episode uh-huh. with the monsters are due on Maple Street. I find it fascinating at the end because the morality, like we figure out what is right, just, and fair. And at the end, you know, the monsters, I guess, or the aliens, they leave and the narrator says, well, you know, you were not going to be destroyed by
some external threat.
Is that it's planted within the mind of prejudice.
Prejudices can kill.
And the thing was very powerful with the prejudice and the belief system and how he said, yeah, basically we can plant a seed in somebody's mind. And if that seed grows, it can be deadly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we want to give like a spoiler alert? Do we want to talk about some of the details of the...
Oh, spoiler. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think the teachers could watch it, but I think they can throw it in and say, what is it? You know, what's the title of this? I mean, it doesn't really... Spoiling. I mean, yeah, it shows that I find it fascinating because right, just, and fair is all based on experience. It's based on what you think and how can a government make it fair, right, and just. And I said, you know, the Fourth through the Eighth Amendment, I think, is probably the best way to give a baseline with the substantive yeah. due process. They've only tried to further strengthen mistakes that they've made. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things you could discuss, and I talk to my students about the failures of this right just system, is the Innocence Project, which is, I think, is based in Texas, isn't it?
I don't remember where it originated, but there's a pretty active chapter in Texas. In fact, one of my law professors was heading it up, David Dow.
Okay. You know, we talk about, well, what is fair, right, and just? And we talk about race and gender, we also talk about rich versus poor and how can in a system where the Constitution lays out these fundamental rights that we can all think we can agree on, that there is still, there isn't justice for everybody. And that episode at the end just is a perfect example of like, well, what's in the minds of the people? How can you control the minds of the people when they've made the decisions themselves?
And this actually connects pretty nicely to the idea of common law. Just to go a little bit into that, there was a period of time where almost all criminal law was common law, meaning it was not written in statutes. It was more or less judge-made law. It was the consequence of case after case coming before juries and having certain outcomes. And so early in our nation's history, juries would decide matters of law and fact. And basically what would happen is the prosecutors would come with the accused and they would lay out the case. The accused could give their defense and the jury would decide what was the right outcome. Today, juries are there to decide matters of fact, and the judges are there to decide matters of law. Matters of law, meaning the proper courtroom procedures being followed, rules of evidence, and things like that. But with the common law, it was very much up to a jury of 12 to come up with a unanimous verdict of what they thought was right and appropriate in terms of not just guilt, but also what punishment should be. So it was based on this collective and very powerful sense of what is right and what is wrong. But over time, both in Britain and in the United States, we started codifying a lot of those crimes and saying, okay, no, this is what this is. These are the elements of the crime that you have to prove. You do have to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and make sure that judges are there to make sure that all of that is followed so that everything is fair. That's how due process kind of evolved. Because originally, due process of law, where the phrase comes from, and you had mentioned Article 39 or Clause 39 of the Magna Carta. By the way, that's Clause 39 from the 1215. In later versions, the clauses get renumbered. But it says, and it's originally in Latin, this is the English translation, that no free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any other way, nor will we, meaning the king, proceed with force against him or send others to do so except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. Now, law of the land in Latin, legem terrae, or in the nominative case, lex terrae. Lord Cook, who was a chief justice in Britain in the 1600s, in his notes on the Magna Carta, he translates legem terrae as due process of law. And that is more or less where that phrase comes from. And when they talk about this law of the land, they're talking about this common law, massive collective sense of right and wrong for these, for different circumstances. You know, and of course that evolves. And like I said, you know, a lot of it gets codified over time.
I wanted to go back to the closing because I didn't get all of it, but it was, for the record, prejudices can kill and suspicion can destroy. And they talk about the weapons are thoughts, attitudes, and prejudices. And to have guilt beyond a reasonable doubt ensures that, you know, if you are going to be found guilty of a crime, hopefully that the jury of the peers judge the evidence correctly without this bias. You know, my students ask, is like, is it ever even possible for that to happen? And we looked at current cases and we brought up O.J. Simpson, we brought up Casey Anthony, we brought up George Zimmerman, where you had jury members say, oh, we didn't know the law, we didn't understand, there's no conviction, and people get outraged. It's like, well, how can a jury, and we don't send in there, obviously, the evidence, but maybe possibly think those are guilty or free, or for the record of how many people, especially black males through the Innocence Project, have been wrongly convicted based on this idea of the thoughts and attitudes and prejudices of the jury. It's a, you know, catch 22. You want a jury of your peers, but they have their own biases, you know. How can you get a fair trial, period?
And one of those specific rights is for an impartial jury. you know, before the trial begins, before the jury is seated, there's the process that we here in Texas call voir dire, but everybody else calls voir dire because it's from a French term. But that's basically the process of questioning potential jurors, questioning the panel of jurors to make sure that they don't have, or to do your best anyway, to make sure that they don't have prejudices and biases and no interest whatsoever in the case. And so you do that to ensure that. But then some of the stuff that you touched on is like, well, the jurors say in retrospect, well, we didn't know what the law was. The jurors are always going to get jury instructions from the judge. And I would encourage people to just consider this possibility that if there's cases that happen in the future where you think to yourself, wow, how could 12 people come to that conclusion, that maybe the focus should actually be on what instructions did the jurors get from the judge? Because sometimes I think, and I think this happened in the Zimmerman case, that there were some of the instructions to the jurors that had been proposed by the defense that maybe should have been challenged by the prosecution, but weren't. Now, having said that, I've never been a prosecutor. I've never been a defense attorney. So I'm not speaking from a position of expertise, but I'm just saying at the very least, that is worth questioning too, that, hey, let's go over the instructions that the judge actually gave rather than put the fault on the jurors.
I guess there's things in place that protect and we can correct the mistakes of the past and juries. Not that these men can get time back, but there are organizations that look at this idea of what is fair, right, and just and say, this man, this woman didn't receive a fair trial, and we can rectify that situation to make sure we honor what the Constitution says and these ideas of fundamental rights. Because, you know, all the corrections that have had to be made by law have had to come because of the prejudices of the people, the prejudices of the government. And I think that's what people looked at with the civil rights movement is that, like the King's promissory note, that, you know, they got a promissory note that was returned with insufficient funds. And the people looked and said, yeah, we're not upholding the principles of the Declaration or the Constitution. And this is not who we are. And we continue to battle that because, like in the episode, is that, you know, there's a strong identification of those who are different than the mainstream. They don't act right. They don't look right. They really kind of address that. And in 1960, we have to think about who are the ones that don't act right or don't look the same and who are not like the typical American suburb.
Absolutely. And this episode did come out in 1960, and it is a pretty direct metaphor of McCarthyism.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, it's 1960. I mean, McCarthy's already dead by then. Why are they raising this? Well, for one thing, it does make a pretty entertaining episode. But also, as you said, civil rights was becoming of increasing concerns. In 1954, the court said schools need to desegregate. And in a lot of states, they were like, okay, we'll get around to it. And there was a lot of foot dragging and a lot of resistance and a lot of increasing violence directed at people who were other. And so this does make kind of a tie-in. I mean, it's definitely the same kind of darker elements of human nature that come out where when you give over to your fears and suspicions and let those govern you, there isn't going to be fairness.
Yeah, there's only a couple times where I see my students watching a black and white show and they're interested and engaged. And this one was really powerful. And then sometimes I show Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and they're just like, they're really not paying attention on their phones. And then when he gets up and does the filibuster, it's like, and they're just glued to it. And I said, I wish I could take a picture of your guys' faces when you're just all of a sudden, bam, that you're captured with it. So I think it's a good reflection. And I think looking back at 1960 and looking at it today, the events, I mean, these things are, they span generations.
Yeah.
Because, oh, Dr. King, they had their civil rights movement history, so it should all be done now, or women's rights, or, you know, gay rights. Well, that's a thing in the past, or we don't have to deal with that now. But injustice still is everywhere. If one person faces injustice, then What do we
than
do?
Anybody can.
Yeah, than anybody can, right?
And yeah, absolutely. And this is one of those occasions that I just kind of like get up on my soapbox and give a speech to my students that we always have to be mindful of our liberties, that it is fine if we as a free people are jealous of the power of government and suspicious of it, because that can be turned into kind of a healthy attitude to make sure that we're guarding the rights that we have and don't take them for granted. And when it comes to civil rights, you know, I tell my students that's chapters in your U.S. history textbook, but you shouldn't think of it as just chapters in your U.S. history textbook. Civil rights is in our past, it's in our present, it's in our future. And we should never think of it as anything other than something that is always here and always things that need to be fought for in whatever way, with whatever challenge comes against them. And maybe one day in the future, if we do attain being that shining city on the hill, it won't be a concern any longer. But until such time, it's something we always need to be mindful of.
Yeah. And I think with that, we can close out this episode. Right now, I'm just making sure that, you know, the AP government teachers out there, that these activities are, this is in the share drive. Mm-hmm. That you can look at it. And you and I talk that you teach government in a semester and I teach it in a semester, and we are really crunched with time. But I found this one to really hit home with my government students, and they really enjoyed it. Andrew, I want to thank you for coming on again for number two. Hey, did you get the patch I sent you?
Yes, I did. I do have it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
I want to give a plug out to your podcast. It's Radio Owls, correct?
It's Radio Owls, and I haven't updated it lately. I've been kind of busy with a lot of stuff, but the Radio Owls podcast is really just a current events discussion that I do mainly for my students, but anybody can listen to it. And it's mainly because there are some current events that we just don't have time to discuss in class.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You're on Podomatic, and yep. Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter, but I'm on Twitter as myself, A.E. Okay. McBurney.
A.E. McBurney. Okay, well, Andrew, thanks for coming on. And you can follow the Government Gurus on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at GovGurus, and we're on Podomatic, Spotify, and whatever system you can access your podcasts, including Apple and Google Play Store. So I want to thank Andrew again.
Hey, thank you.
Have a good one.